Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now it's time for our Friday gathering, and they've already started. I'm joined by Green Party Senator Pauline O'Reilly, Irish Times political editor Pat Leahy, columnist Brenda Power, and Sinn Féin TD for Cavan Monaghan, Matt Carthy. And you're all very welcome. Thank you for being here this morning. Matt, you had a late night, I'm sure, keeping abreast of the election results for your colleagues.
For sure, but I don't feel tired.
A good night.
It was a great night. Mm-hmm. I think the results in the north were actually seismic in so many different ways. The Sinn Féin vote, we were told by commentators throughout the campaign that it was a dull, lacklustre campaign.
Well, that's what we heard here on the programme. That was how it was characterised. The results don't seem to bear that out for you.
No, even what would have been considered marginal Sinn Féin seats going into the election, North Belfast, Fermanagh, South Tyrone, the Sinn Féin vote increased substantially, and the margins increased in all the other seats that we held. Our margins increased substantially. We came into play in East Derry phenomenally, coming just 179 votes behind Gregory Campbell. We were on the verge of unseating.
There was a late recount, wasn't there? With that,
yeah, one. I think it was 179 votes in the end. To give it in context, Aintu, who hadn't previously stood, they got, I think, just around 1,000 votes. If they hadn't stood, Gregory Campbell would no longer be an MP today.
So what are you going to do with that now? Because, you know, we were talking about Keir Starmer, who said before the election, border poll isn't on the horizon for me, but you're the largest party now in regional party with Westminster seats in Stormont and in the local government as well. So where does it go from here? What are you expecting from Keir Starmer?
Well, I think in the first instance, actually, the challenge is here in Ireland, because I do think that the results last night move us one step closer to a united Ireland. And what's imperative is that we actually start to plan for that. And that means that the Irish government in particular takes a proactive role in all of that. We've seen civic society have a discussion and debate that's intensifying over recent years. And we've always said we don't want to make the mistake of the Brexiteers. We don't want to have a referendum and the day after the referendum, everyone shrugging their shoulders as to what happens next. We want to ensure that a united Ireland is a successful endeavour, which I believe it can be. And that means that we need to start working towards it, and we need all political parties who are of that persuasion to plan for it together. Yeah. But we also need civil engagement to ensure, as I say.
Deirdre Heenan was suggesting earlier on that the first question for Keir Starmer from you guys would be, what are the conditions under which a border poll would be called? Is that something that you're... Because here you have somebody who said, I'm not going there. It's not even on the agenda. It's not on the horizon for me now. So what is the conversation with Keir Starmer?
Well, I think in fairness, I think the very first conversation that Michelle O'Neill and I think all ministers in the executive will be putting to Keir Starmer will be to see a reversal of the savage Tory austerity, which has made their jobs much more difficult in terms of delivering public services and key infrastructure developments. So that'll be the first conversation naturally. In terms of the Irish unity issue, yes, the conversations with the British Labour Party will revolve around the context in which a unity poll takes place. But we've never made any secret of the fact that the primary objective in the first instance is to ensure that the conditions are so that when a poll takes place that we actually win it and that we deliver a united Ireland in a successful way that's actually beneficial to all the people of the 32 counties of Ireland.
Pauline O'Reilly beside you there. The Greens did relatively well in the UK elections. I mean, they have four seats.
Yeah,
from one to four.
Absolutely. Now, we were discussing this before we came on the show. I was talking about how amazing the result was, and four seats mightn't sound like a lot to people, and it doesn't actually outside of the system in Britain. But I mean, we got nearly 2 million votes, and we got four seats for those 2 million votes. And if you look at the Labour Party, for every 24,000 votes, they got an MP, and that's the system that we're dealing with. It's the first past the post, but it's truly historic for the Greens. And I think what it really does is that it actually puts the government under pressure, because obviously there is a groundswell of support for green measures, and therefore they're going to have to implement them.
Well, there was a big pull back from green and environmental strategy during this campaign, wasn't there, from all sides?
Well, I wouldn't say that, obviously, from the Green Party's point of view, no.
Because from the Conservatives.
From the Conservatives, there was. And the Labour Party, I mean, I don't see this which what it is an historic victory in some ways for the Labour Party, but they've got 2/3 of the seats, but they've only got 1/3 of the votes.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to be under pressure from the electorate. They're going to be under pressure from people who have other interests other than what they've brought to the table in this election.
Yeah.
And part of that is Green. But I mean, there's lots of other issues for people. But I think it was quite a negative vote for them in some ways, and they're going to have to use those seats in a different way than maybe they campaigned.
A kickback against the Tories rather than a vote for Keir Starmer.
And you look at like the same fate, and obviously I'm pleased that that Reform didn't get more seats, but at the same time, you know, they also got 4 seats like ourselves, but they had a huge vote increase. And so, you know, again, there have to be lessons there, I think, for the government. There have to be lessons for the Tory party as well. But it's not for me to tell them how to do their business. Okay. But for us, it was a really important moment to go from 1 seat to 4 seats.
Brenda, yeah, what was your takeaway from last night? Like, was it Ian Paisley Jr.? Was it the performance of the Reform Party? What stood out for you?
I really do believe that I think you're right, Pauline, that this wasn't so much a vote for Labour as a vote against the Conservative Party. Any of the vox pops that I heard in the run-up to the election, where people were saying, look, you know, not thrilled with Labour, but I'm certainly not voting for the Tories again. And I mean, I would see it as almost an oblique anti-Brexit vote and a sort of a tacit admission that they got it wrong. I was looking at a poll that The Guardian, now of course they would say that, wouldn't they, a few months ago, 78% of people in the UK now believe Brexit was a mistake. And, you know, this was entirely the Tory party's baby over the last 14 years. They drove it, they held the referendum, and then they got Brexit done. The absolute brass neck of Boris Johnson to come out in the last few days in the hope that he could sway the vote against the Labour Party when he was the architect of Brexit and the single culprit for the damage that has inflicted. Mm. So I think I look at the figures, and as you say, Pauline, it's extraordinary. You know, with 2 million votes, the Greens have 4 seats. With 4 million votes, Reform have 4 seats. And with, I think, 63% or 33% of the vote, Labour have an overwhelming majority. But I do not believe that is a huge vote for Labour in the sense, in an ideological sense. I think it's an anti-Tory vote. And I mean, poor old Sunak ran the most disastrous campaign from the day he stood outside Downing Street in the lashing rain.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he couldn't even adjust
the D-Day fiasco.
Yeah, the D-Day fiasco. What were you most deprived of as a multimillionaire kid growing up? We didn't have Sky TV. I mean, it was just one blunder after another.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think the Labour Party really can rest on its laurels, as you're saying, Pauline. Yeah. I think there's a lot of challenges.
Pat, what's your assessment? Keir Starmer have to be careful with this, despite the fact that he has how many? 412 seats?
Yeah, I know there's a school of thought, and one of his biographers has written about this, that actually, you know, when he goes into number 10, on his way there, he'll pop into he'll jump into a telephone box, to the extent that such things still exist, and will emerge as bold reformer Keir Starmer. I have my doubts about that.
Alistair Campbell was sort of suggesting that last night on the Channel 4 coverage. You know, don't underestimate Keir Starmer. He's going to go in and hit the ground running. But no one really saw that Keir Starmer during the campaign.
I think he will go in and hit the ground running, but I think he will be cautious, because that's who he is. Any of us who've looked at his career, you know, since he was Brexit spokesman, let's not forget, for Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader of the Labour Party, that his approach has been marked by caution. Mm-hmm. I think he will do, or he will try to do, many of the things in his manifesto. He will be seeking to promote economic growth above anything, because without that, he can't do the investment in infrastructure and in public services that very many voters seem to want. I mean, the other big takeaway I would have thought from it, aside altogether to mention in passing the efficiency of the British counts and not having had to, you know, sit through the lengthy process as I await the verdict
it's
of the voters on me, like some
though,
of our.
Pat,
there is something to be said, I think, with getting
for
it
the
done,
pace of it,
getting it,
yep.
Getting it done quickly. But that aside, for me, one of the big takeaways is the volatility in Western electorates now. We've seen this, and Matt, of course, will know this, but in every single election in this country since 2011, there's been a huge swing one way or the other. We're now beginning to see the same thing in the UK. Will we see it? We've seen it in France. Will we see it in the US in the autumn? But that appears to be baked in now, that voters, all these Western countries, we saw it in Holland as well relatively recently, have a, and across, indeed across Europe in the European elections, the
wild
level
swing.
Of a wild swing, very often all going in one direction. And at the heart of that, I think, is just not the way our political discourse is different now, but the fact that voter loyalty to established parties is at an all-time low. They are untethered by the loyalties that parties used to attract from lots and lots of voters. The amount of votes...
But we didn't see that borne out in the recent local and European elections here.
Well, didn't we, really?
Well, we saw the establishment parties holding firm, didn't we?
We saw a massive swing away from Sinn Féin. That was the big swing.
But the expectation was that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would do really badly, and they didn't. They held.
I'm not sure that was really the expectation, was it? Mm-hmm. I would have thought there was an expectation that they would lose seats, as they did, but that they would be seeking to minimise those losses. The big surprise, as Matt, I'm sure, would admit, was the extent of the flow away from Sinn Féin. And this is the point I make about this bunch of voters that are not loyal to any parties and can often, in the course of a campaign and making their minds up late, can swing in one direction. Mm. And that makes elections and politics more generally extremely unpredictable.
OK, let's... bring it back to our own politics now, because I had the Taoiseach on earlier, Brenda, and I asked him again about the election, because it was interesting what Micheál Martin said on Morning Ireland, that the election would happen when this government has run its term. But he didn't exclusively mention next year. Simon Harris did.
He did. Last night I saw him on the news and he said it again. So,
right, so.
He cannot possibly. No, in fairness.
Where are we?
If he wants to be trusted by the electorate. Now, he cannot turn around in 3 or 4 months' time and say, actually, I think I will do what has been predicted by yourself, I think, Pat, among others, all along, a November the 15th election. I think that's the date that seems to have been the
8th or the 15th, I think, is what is most likely.
How can he possibly turn around now, having said unequivocally on a couple of occasions in the last couple of days alone, when the direct question was put to him? I mean, of course, the speculation is that the reason for bringing forward the budget is really nothing to do with some meeting in Europe that
Jack has
to
go to. Yeah,
that he has to go to in Europe.
But what did you guys say that was? Cock and bull story?
That was Piers Doherty who said that. He's much more crass than I am. But I have to say, yeah, it's an excuse. I just don't think it's a very good one for bringing forward the budget by a week, particularly as we know that the September tax returns are actually so important for delivery of the budget in terms of understanding precisely where the coffers are. So I do believe, regardless of what Simon Harris or anyone else has said, that we are... October-November election is much more likely now than it was previously. Regardless of when it is, you know, I would much prefer if we didn't have another budget from this government, because I think they have had their priorities all wrong. The truth is, the longer this government is in power, the worse the housing crisis is going to get. One of the stated reasons, and this is actually said quite publicly by members of government in the Dáil, for not waiting until January or February, is that the cost of living crisis will be hitting hard in the new year, and that the waiting lists and overcrowding in hospital will be more acute. It's essentially acknowledging the failures of this government as one of the reasons why they want to go to an election earlier. So,
okay, so Pauline, can I come to you on this? Because if we hear from Micheál Martin in particular, because I think it was more nuanced what he said this morning, that the election will happen, this government will run its full term. If you do the budget that's signed, sealed and delivered, does that represent running a full term for you?
Well, look, we are nearly up on the 5 years. We obviously, the Greens, we've always said that we want to run to the absolute deadline, because for us, I think it was a very successful negotiation for Programme for Government. We have achieved a lot in government and we want to make sure that we're there as long as possible as the smallest party. And, you know, to go back to, I think, the words of Michael Healy-Rae, we're the tail wagging the dog, according to the Healy-Rae party. we want to make sure that we stay there. But look, it's not.
Do you trust that it's going to go?
It's not going to be up to us. Right. I think that's the reality. I think what's happened here is they've given themselves a bit of flexibility, but I don't think it's. I don't think it's a definitive answer.
Do you think
or
Simon Harris can?
Indication.
Is it acceptable now, given what he has said so many times, that he would call the election in November?
I think it's probably challenging for him, because those words will come back to haunt him if he does call it early. You know, but how long do people remember these things? I don't know.
He wouldn't be the first Fine Gael Taoiseach to break a promise.
Well, I don't know how, you know, how the electorate will really. Will that really land for the electorate? Probably not. Mm. I think it's still going to be a matter of going at the time that they decide. But I think to Pat's words earlier, I think things are much more flexible in the minds of the electorate. And so you can never be certain when you call an election how it's going to go, no matter what the polls say. So I think you always have to be.
Sorry, I was just going to say that is one reason, and I know, Matt, you'd prefer if there was an early election, or you say you would, but actually one of the reasons, or one of the you know, explanations given for why the government might want to go early, is not to give you a chance to regroup after what was a pretty disastrous local and European tournament.
Yeah, maybe that's part of, and that has been obviously one of the stated reasons. I think it's actually a good thing that people don't feel that they owe a political party anything on the basis of how their mother or father voted. I remember when I first ran for a town council election as a 21-year-old, I was taken aback when one of the people I went to school with said, "I can't vote for you because my father would kill me, we're Fianna Fáil family." And then in 2020, I was speaking to an elderly woman who said, "I am voting for Sinn Féin because my grandchild has convinced me." And I just think that's a really positive thing in politics, that people can make up their minds. Now, that's not to say that the manipulation of that through online and other sources, and, you know, doesn't make it more difficult. But at the end of the day, regardless of what the people decide in any electoral contest, they're right. And it's our job as political representatives to convince them.
But do you
that
need
there is
more
a better
time
way
than you would be given if the election were in November to regroup?
No, I think the political circumstances will be the same regardless of when the election takes place, in that we will be dealing with a situation that we have an outgoing government that thinks €475,000 represents an affordable home, completely detached from the reality of most people's lives. A government that has simply shrugging its shoulders at the fact that you have the health services taking money for one purpose in terms of providing treatment to scoliosis children, and then just not doing that, that all of those things are accepted as standard practice, where you have lots of people in really difficult
financial circumstances. Will you be quick off the mark? When the next election happens, will you extend the hand quickly now to Fianna Fáil to try and, you know, get your place at the table when it comes to government formation? Because you're a bit slow out of the traps the last time. You said you wanted to do business, but they'd all dismissed you before you got there.
No, the first people we'll be reaching the hand out to is the electorate, the men and women of voting age across the 40-odd constituencies, and asking them to give us an opportunity in the first instance to elect a government that doesn't include either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, because I do believe that that is still a live prospect.
Will.
And then after the election, we will try and form that government, but we will not close the door on anybody who has a mandate, because that's not what grown-ups do, quite frankly. Mm-hmm.
And what can we expect then from this budget? Jack Chambers in charge for the first time. Pat, the temptation will be to spend, but the warnings are coming most recently this morning from the central bank not to do that.
Yeah, the central bank governor this morning advising the government not to break its rule of not increasing spending by more than 5% a year. That rule was introduced in 2001. It has never been kept by the government, and I'd be amazed if it's kept this year again. I mean, it is useful in internal budgetary negotiations for the Department of Finance and the Department of Public Expenditure, who are always trying to, it's just the structure of the way we do budgets, they're always trying to limit the demands of their colleagues around the cabinet table. So
this
having
is, this
the rule
is going
there,
to be a giveaway budget. I mean, the timing of it, it couldn't be anything else.
Of course it's going to be a giveaway budget. What will be discussed over and what will be at issue being those months behind closed doors negotiations that will be commencing shortly is how big a giveaway budget it will be. The last two budgets were budget day packages of about 10, 11 billion. I'd be amazed, some of that made up of one-off giveaways, others made up of structural increases to spending. Spending increases running at nearly 10% already this year. So spending is increasing, but revenues are increasing. And there is a constant demand from the public for improvements in public services. Now, the extent to which you get improvements in public services for increased spending is a whole other discussion. But yes, there will be a giveaway budget. How big it is, how it is framed, that's what's going to be decided.
Along the lines of the last budget then, you're saying, is what you'd expect to see.
So I think if you look at what the budget ministers have been saying, they're very clear that they want to ease off on the one-off giveaways. Things like the energy credits, the double payment of social welfare benefits, child benefit and so on, that featured in the last two budgets because inflation has come down. But cost of living is still, as you know, Matt, I'm sure would attest on the doorsteps, cost of living is still a huge issue. It's a massive issue. It was a massive issue in the UK. It is still a massive issue in the US. And there will be that demand. And the great thing about the one-off giveaways for the purposes of government framing a budget, particularly before an election, is you can deliver the money fairly quickly, but you are not putting it into
spending.
Your recurring spending bills. And therefore, it works a little bit better on your budgetary arithmetic.
Okay. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. Back with more from The Gathering after this. Now, The Gathering still with us, and we have Brenda Power, Pat Leahy, Matt Carthy and Pauline O'Reilly. Joe Biden. Brenda Power. Joe Biden. What to do about Joe?
What to do about Joe is Joe needs to withdraw from the race.
Really?
Now. Oh, come on. I mean, it was embarrassing. It was upsetting. It was really difficult to watch. And the sight of that horrible creep, Trump, crowing over this elderly man stumbling and forgetting his sentences and not trailing off without losing his train of thought was just really alarming. I mean, is this really the best that the United States can put up?
Yeah, he's doing
presidents?
This interview now with George Stephanopoulos, yeah. Isn't he, where he's going to sit down, I think it's for 15 or 20 minutes, and there's a lot riding on that, isn't there?
There's
and
a lot
over
riding
a couple
on.
Of other appearances he's doing over the weekend.
Apparently, during the debate, his team started to put out a spin that he was he had a cold. But I don't think anybody buys that, really. You know, when he is in that sort of situation where he can't be managed and he can't be prompted and he's not got an auto cue, he does flounder. He absolutely does. And I mean, it is his age. And it's not ageist to say that at 86, which he will be if he gets this second term, that he is too old for the job. And the man that we saw in that debate last week is just not up to this. And I saw him, Jill Biden, say, oh, he's not just the best man, he's the only man. Well, that's a shame on him, because he should have been succession planning before this. What has happened to Kamala Harris? I mean, clearly she didn't set the world on fire as vice president. A, that's his poor judgment for picking her. But B, why wasn't she given prominence? Why wasn't, or and if she wasn't the one to take over, then why didn't he promote somebody else to a position of prominence? He has prepared nobody to step in for him, and the position is now there doesn't seem to be anybody else. Gavin Newsom is the name being mentioned. Maybe I saw Bernie Sanders being mentioned someplace. There's nobody really credibly in a position to take over from. And it looks like they're handing Donald Trump the presidency, and I kind of blame Jill Biden, because I think she's the one pushing him to stay. I saw a quote from her. She addressed some rally afterwards, and she said, you know, Joe said to me, that didn't go so well. I'm not really sure what happened. I didn't feel great. And she said, oh, no, Joe, we're not going to let those 90 minutes determine how your 5 years or 4.5 years are viewed, 3.5 years. That's a man saying, please, can I step down? And her saying, no, get back in there.
Ah, no, come on.
Identified the villain of the piece.
I think, well, they had that big meeting, didn't they, at Camp David last weekend with the whole family. And what emerged from that was that Hunter as well.
Hunter. Of all people. Grandfella to have advice.
A man to give life advice to anyone, you know.
Pat, what's your view of it and Joe Biden? Do you think he should stay?
Well, I'm always very careful never to blame the wife for as you'd imagine. Look, it was really depressing watching that. And I suppose, you know, Irish people will have so many different mixed emotions, because Joe Biden, as has often been said, has been a very strong friend to Ireland over many years. Yet many Irish people are deeply disappointed in his response to what's happening in Gaza in particular, and his allegiance to Israel, as it's seen. But at the end of the day, the Democratic Party will make a decision. Generally speaking, parties, you know, of that nature can be quite ruthless. But time is very short in
like
terms
that's
of
the dilemma,
US
isn't it?
Election cycle. Generally speaking, you know, there are candidates already planning for 4 years' time in terms of their presidential prospects and their and putting in place the campaign teams, to just spring somebody at this late stage, because regardless of what people's view on Joe Biden is or his capacity or anything else, the prospect of a Trump that will seem to have virtually unlimited powers as a re-elected president is quite worrying, I have to say.
Because, I mean, these names that are thrown around like Gavin Newsom and Gretchen Whitmer, all grand, like governors and well-known in their states, but puts somebody on the national stage at this really late point and, you know, in the run-up to the elections, they could run into huge problems, the Democrats here. It's a real Hobson's choice, isn't it?
They've got to roll the dice, though. I mean, it's very obvious, like what happened in the debate is kind of unspinnable, you know, no matter what they say. People saw it, they've made up their minds about it. And, you know, I mean, Biden gave quite a forceful performance the following day at a rally, I think, in North Carolina. But I think the nature of that sort of old age related decline is that you have good days and you have bad days. And as you get older, the bad days become more frequent and good days less so. But I think that Biden cannot win now. It's likely that whoever a replacement candidate, Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, even Kamala Harris, it's likely that they probably won't win. But Biden can't win, I think. So you've got to assume that the Democratic Party will act in its own interests. It's a bit like the date of the election here. You've got to assume that the government parties will act in their own interests and go early.
And
just
he can't
like,
win based on that performance, or because every time we see him, we're going to be studying him and watching
like a combination
him
of both. Yeah,
mm.
I think. And also there's, you know, the possibilities if he does stay in the race of future slips. What happens if he slips going down aircraft steps, you know, or something like that?
Well, she had to rush up and help him off the stage to stop him falling.
Yeah, there was some talk in the last couple of days that this isn't a question about him running for the presidency. It's about him remaining on in office now, which is probably an even more...
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much at stake when you're talking about the president of the US. Yeah. And like as Matt said, and I completely agree, we have very mixed feelings in Ireland now about him. I'd say we're more negative towards him than positive overall because of the situation in Gaza. So I think we're looking at it probably with a biased view as well when we're seeing him. Actually, the entire debate wasn't that bad. It's the clips, the tiny clips that are taken out that just make it look so terrible. But people have had bad debates in the past and they've still won. So it doesn't always define who wins an election, but I think it's just so bad this time that it probably will.
I wonder what it's going to take, though, for him to opt out.
He has the opportunity to do it. I was kind of hoping that maybe we might see something during this, interview that we see later today, but I don't know. I think it's too soon.
It'll take a powerhouse. It'll take a Clinton or an Obama.
Yeah, to push him out.
Or both of them plus congressional leadership.
But they did raise $33 million in the aftermath of the debate. I think it was mostly from smaller donors, but it didn't seem to be that any of the large donors were actually moving very far away from him. There was talk of Michelle Obama because an Ipsos poll showed that she was the only one who could come along and beat Donald Trump. And it's just interesting then that you see some allies speaking to the New York Times and you wonder, are there all sorts of nefarious things happening here? Maybe
in politics, surely not.
Given the esteemed company that we sit in, I would never make that allegation. All right, listen, we'll leave that there. Thank you all for coming in. Pat Leahy, Brenda Power, Matt Carthy and Pauline O'Reilly. We'll take a quick break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.